Thank you for joining us today. My name is Michael Brown, and we are here today at Villanova University recording another installment of the Voices of Villanova's Veterans. All right, today is April 3rd, 2019, and today I am joined by Thomas Fitzpatrick, a World War II veteran of the United States Army Air Corps, and we're going to listen to his story about his time before, during, and after the service, and we are very excited to be here today with you and to hear that story. So, to get things started, talk to me about where you were born, where you grew up, and what your family was like.
I was born in 1924. My dad had been in World War I, and he married shortly after he was discharged. My sister was born in 1922, and I was born in 24. Things were pretty rural. The country was really just growing up back then. Horses were still a big mode of transportation for milk delivery, bread delivery, and even wholesale delivery. Because my dad had a little grocery store when he first got out of the military, and they delivered a lot of wholesale things with a double team of horses. And of course, you know, it was right after World War I, but I knew a lot of the boys of 98, the Rough Riders, you know, I knew a lot of them. And I knew a couple of Civil War veterans and a couple of freed slaves. Because it wasn't that far, you know, time was pretty short right in that period. Civil War was over in 64, and a lot of them were young enough to still be active in my childhood. Mm-hmm. So we lived in Winmore, and as I say, it was fairly rural. I remember, these were back in the Depression years.
Right.
And my father bought me a 16-gauge shotgun when I was about 12 or 14. And he said, if you have some time, put a little meat on the table, boy. So I could go out in the morning before going to school in my area and bring home a couple of pheasants for dinner, that sort of thing.
And how often did you do that sort of thing? Did you go out hunting?
Quite. I still do.
Well, hence why you bought a chainsaw just the other day.
I did that quite frequently, at least once or twice a week.
Okay.
We ate a lot of pheasant those days. Now it's about $80 a plate in the Four Seasons. But the time I went in the military, I was a dead shot, you know. So I went to Seven Dollars Grade School and Northeast Catholic High School. Our whole class graduated in 1942, and we all went in the military. We're all just of an age. I wasn't quite old enough, but I got a job with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which was just opened a new laboratory in my neighborhood. And that was probably the best move I ever made, because I worked there for 10 months, and then I knew I was going to be drafted, so I enlisted in the Air Corps. They opened it up for non-college graduates. Before that, it was college graduates. But I try to, you know, convey how rural and how the country was still in its infancy back then. Things were very rural, and in fact, I liked it very much that way. You could go fishing in clean streams, and
right. Everything was pristine.
Very pristine.
So, what made you? What was so alluring about the Air Corps? What made you say, you know, that's the choice I want to make, as opposed to a different branch?
Well, I always, my father was an artilleryman. But I always thought I wanted to be a flyer, even when I was a kid. I say that because when an aircraft would fly over, you'd call out all the neighbors. It was such a rarity. And we'd all see this plane flying over. And I actually met one of the Wright brothers. He died in 1947, Orville Wright. But that was when I was in the military. But it was the coming thing, you know. Just like space travel is today for some of these younger chaps. So I took the examination to be an aviation cadet, and I guessed at half the answers, but I got a 99 on the test, and I was in.
Well, good.
A very stringent physical.
Sure.
And eye exam, of course, which I wish I had them today. But we went down to Keesler Field, Mississippi, and we got complete infantry training. And that was in the summer, and Mississippi is very hot and uncomfortable in the summer.
Correct.
Then the 50-mile hike or whatever it was. And we qualified with the machine guns and everything else. And I enjoyed that a lot before, but then we traveled by troop train from Mississippi to northern Minnesota. That's about as long a train ride as you can get. And that was on a troop train.
Also a big change of climate, Mississippi to Minnesota.
It was. But a troop train is run just like a military camp. You get off, you have drill, you have mess, you know, everything else. And we were with a bunch of infantry, mostly. It was only about 30 of us. So we went to Moorhead, Minnesota. An interesting aside, I was interviewed in Flower Town a couple of months ago for their archives in Chestnut Hill. And the girl that interviewed me was from Moorhead, Minnesota.
Wow.
Little spot on the earth that I never knew there were. It was Moorhead State Teachers College. That's where we had our aviation cadet training. And right across the river in Fargo, North Dakota, we learned to fly at Fargo Airport. And that was a nice interlude. The people out there hardly knew there was a war on, you know. But I guess we were there for about 3 months or so. And then we traveled to Santa Ana, California. Am I getting ahead of my...
No, you're good. So, okay. So first you're in Mississippi. You take a train right up to Minnesota. You're there for around 3 months. What year is this?
43, I guess.
So this is right in the middle of the war.
Yeah.
And now you're headed off to California. And what are you doing in California?
That was for finding out where you were going to be on the plane, classification. Now, I was still like 18 years old. I didn't even have a driver's license. And even though I flew pretty well in Fargo, they thought I did a good job. I wasn't cut out to be a pilot. One thing, it was going to be in the bombers, and they were all four-engine, and my hand wasn't big enough for the four throttles. You have four individual throttles. But I guess there were other reasons. But I could have been a bombardier, but I didn't feel like I wanted to be a bombardier. So I chose to be a radio operator, a radio navigator, actually. We had a celestial navigator on board who was commissioned officer. But I was kind of a secondary navigator, radio navigator, they called it. And so we trained. We were formed into a crews. We went to, after we had classification and we found out what we were going to be, we went to Florida, where we were formed into crews. And we stuck with these guys for the rest of the war. So we then trained on B-17s flew all over Florida, night flights and everything else. And one thing we did down there, that was getting my airfields mixed up. But anyhow, the Memphis Belle had flown there. Are you familiar with the old Memphis Belle?
Yes, sir.
It came back from Europe, and it was stationed at our airfield. So for one reason or another, we won Crew of the Week. As a prize, they're going to let us fly the Memphis Belle up to New York for 3 or 4 days and come back. And we were the last ones to fly the old Memphis Belle. It was kind of rickety when, you know, after 25 missions over Europe.
Right, sure.
But I look back at that as being a real privilege, you know. It was an unusual thing. But
I see you're wearing your Memphis Belle tie today.
Oh, yeah.
So talk to me about what a radio navigator, what is the mission of a radio navigator? For all the listeners out there who maybe have no idea what that means.
Well, I didn't do much navigation, but what I did was very important. As a radio operator, we learned to use Morse code. We had to get up to 25 words a minute and operate all the radio equipment on board, the intercom, and repair everything as well. But the main thing we did was with the old key, we could let out a huge amount of trailing wire antenna, which had a lead ball on the bottom, and you could judge how much antenna you needed by an oral null. You'd have an oral sound on the radio, it went woo down to nothing, and up again. But when you're down in that oral null, that tells you how much trailing wire to send out. And from there, we could transfer halfway around the world. And a friend of mine went to one of these exhibitions for a B-17. He thought the radio room would be a whole phalanx of blinking lights. This little cigar box on the desk was it. And you could, with that radio and that antenna, You could do a good job. Well, after we had trained in Florida, we were ready to go overseas. We flew up to Maine, and it was interesting. They used to fly the bombers from Maine directly to England or Europe, and half of them never made it. So Churchill's idea was to build a base in Newfoundland. This cut several hundred miles off the trip. And that's what we did. We were one of the early crews to land in Newfoundland. They have a big air base there now, but it was pretty primitive when we were there. They had a steel mat runway and 50-gallon drums full of sand and gasoline. And the guy in a Jeep would go down the line and light all these drums for your landing lights, you know? And you came. But we were there. It was under the auspices of the Canadian Air Force. It started to snow, and we had 8 feet of snow. And it was just before Thanksgiving.
8 feet of snow.
8 feet of snow.
Just to clarify.
And we were snowed in there for the best part of a month. And then we were a squadron, you know, we were going to go over in squadron strength. But when it was time to go, we had a malfunction, and we had to stay behind, and the rest of them went without us. So we were there for another week or two. We were flying a special aircraft. It was called a Mickey ship. It had a transmitter in it, which hung below near the lower turret. And what it would do would block the German gunner's transmission, you know, they picked you up on their radios. They had a special operator. This was called a Mickey ship, and he would superimpose a frequency on the German frequency, which would block it. And then he would move along. He was able to block three different German frequencies with his frequency. Hmm. Up until then, we used what they called chaff to disturb the German gunners' radio operators. It was just like Christmas tinsel. You threw bags of this stuff, it would be a big cloud, and it would hide your position. And it helped a good bit, but the Mickey ship was really high science, you know, it was a different situation. But we were flying that ship over. And
so before we get to Europe, I want to talk to you about you growing up in Windmore, you're riding around on horses, and you're living in a rural life. And fast forward a year, you've been to Mississippi, Minnesota, California, Florida, and Maine. Had you ever envisioned that you'd be traveling that much before you got to the age of 19 years old?
No. I'd never been any further than Atlantic City.
And so what was that traveling like, an adjustment like? Were you welcoming that, or were you...
Oh, yes, indeed.
You were happy to be traveling all over the country.
Yeah, I wasn't a homebody or anything like that, you know. We grew up pretty fast back then. I was tending a big vegetable garden and shooting pheasants for the table and all by the time I was 12 or 14 years old. When I went to North Catholic, I guess you know where Windmore is.
Yes, I do.
We walked from Windmore to Germantown Avenue in Chestnut Hill every morning. Got the 23 car down to Broad and Erie. And got the 52 car over to Frankfort, where Northeast Catholic was. We had to be there at 8:30. So you know what time we had to leave Windmore. And for 4 years, I never missed one day of school. I got a certificate for that. I must have been healthy as a pig.
And some days you went hunting for pheasant before you caught the car to the to the school.
Exactly.
So what time were you usually up in the mornings?
Well, during those high school years, I didn't do much morning hunting. Mostly my grade school years. We were up. We had to leave. We got the 7 o'clock trolley in Chestnut Hill. So we probably left Windmore around 6:30. We're up at least by 6 or before that. And I remember I had to pack my own lunch and, you know, that sort of thing. But the biggest surprise I got on commencement night when I got this certificate for complete attendance for 4 years.
Yeah, that's fantastic. No excuses. So now let's go back to Maine. You're about to fly over to Europe. And what are you thinking about? Are you anticipating being part of this war? Are you nervous? What are your thoughts?
No, because it was the problems you had at hand, you know. We were there over Thanksgiving. In fact, the whole squadron hadn't left yet, I might add. And the Newfoundlanders, they were not part of Canada yet. They were independent. They had their own coinage and their own postage. But they had never heard of Thanksgiving. They thought it was a great idea that we set a day aside for Thanksgiving. And we put on, they cleared the tarmac of snow. We put on a military parade. And they thought that was a great thing. So I guess they're still celebrating it, you know.
Thanks to you.
But then we were all alone. One morning, we also needed a tailwind. One morning they woke us up about 4 a.m. and you said, you're good to go. Well, the celestial navigator, he'd been at his cups all the night before, and he was out like a light. So, we, you know, hot coffee, showers, everything else. We could pour him into the airplane, but he wasn't capable of any navigation.
So he had a few too many the night before, is what you're saying.
Exactly. The name was Sharp, Malcolm Sharp. But I had to navigate that bomber from Newfoundland to the Azores And I was 20 years old. And I had, you know, 10 men and a bomber. And I did it with the radio compass and a radio. I triangulated and I called Iceland. And of course, I could call the Azores and Newfoundland, so I could triangulate. And with the radio compass, I could get headings. They figure in the wind and the drift for the Azores. And fortunately, the weather was good all the way across. I could get weather reports from Iceland, and that was in a double code. I had an encode and decode. But we had good weather all the way across, and we finally got to the Azores. And I mentioned earlier about the trailing wire antenna. The airstrip at the Azores was on top of a cliff. And we're coming in, I still thought we had plenty of altitude, and I didn't wind in the trailing wire antenna. And all of a sudden, we're on the ground, and the trailing wire antenna is somewhere in the ocean. First thing out of the plane, a major gave me complete hell. I said, it was only, you know, he wasn't really mad, but they put a new trailing wire antenna on.
Sure.
But that was a big surprise. You know, the Azores was a unique situation. It was owned by Portugal, who were neutral during the war. And they still traded with Germany, particularly minerals. Now, the Germans wanted the Azores for their submarine patrols. Those days, they were wreaking havoc with our shipping, you know, to Russia from the United States. And, of course, we wanted the Azores for an interim stop from Newfoundland to North Africa. Well, it sort of hung fire for a while, but Churchill found an old treaty from 1367 that said we could protect the Azores if they were in danger of being engulfed by a foreign power. And one thing about the Germans, they honed to paperwork, treaty or whatever you had, they stuck to it. So we were able to lease the island of Lodgins, and they built a British airstrip on Lodgins. The Germans had one, we could see the swastika flapping across the water on another island. But we did keep the submarines out of there. And it really helped a lot with our shipping. We were only there for a couple of days, thank goodness. But it was loaded with bubonic plague. These lovely houses, Thot Rouge houses, they said, stay out of them. You know, the rats are in there. And they had a rat patrol. They'd go around every morning and pick up these traps that they had set overnight. And they had this big pit filled with aviation gasoline lit. And they just throw trap, rat and everything into that. So I think now I talked to somebody in recent years who had been there. It's no longer a threat. So we probably did a lot to eradicate most of the bubonic plague. You know?
How many rats are we talking about?
Thousands. So we were told to stay away from stone walls and thatched houses and, as I say, we're only there for two nights, and then we took off. But then the navigator was back on his feet, and we went to North Africa from there. And that was pretty interesting. We went to the French Foreign Legion base at Marrakech. It's still their base at Marrakech. But those days it was primitive. We got there late in the afternoon. They were lined up on the tarmac. They were playing the Marseillaise, taking down the tricolor. And their chant was, Vive les morts, vive les guerres, vive la Légion étrangère. Hooray for death, hooray for war, hooray for the French Foreign Legion. So we were there for a couple of days. I know we ate horse meat at least once, and I think camel. The second day. They don't kill a camel when he's too old to work, so the horse wasn't bad.
The horse wasn't bad. What was the camel like?
On top of the boiled owl, you know. So we're glad to leave.
How long were you there?
Just a couple of days.
And this is what year?
It was still 43.
Okay.
We did get out into the town a little bit as a group. We carried our sidearms and all. That area had been cleared by the British by then. But they were auctioning off girls in the square, and these old Arab chieftains, they were picking them out and buying them for their harems and various things. And the girls were very happy because they were going to a better life than they had been brought up in, obviously. But as I say, it was pretty primitive. But we... they had... in addition to the legionnaires, the French legionnaires, they had the... I'm not sure I'm pronouncing. They had the Guoms. They were part of a French territory in Africa. But they'd kill you as quick as look at you, you know. They were. But and then we hopped across North Africa to Tunis, and I guess we're overnight in Tunis. They took us to some sort of a USO show while we were in Tunis. And there must have been 1,000 GIs in there. But it was a good show. I remember one tenor, and he sang a lot of World War I songs, including Charmaine. You remember Charmaine?
I don't remember Charmaine.
You got to find Charmaine somewhere on a record. And he had a little guy, but a great voice. I don't remember anything else, but I remember Charmaine.
So with this USO, there's 1,000 troops. Did they feed you well? Did they entertain you? What was that experience?
That was the only entertainment that I think we ever got. They fed us well along the line. The USO didn't feed us. I mean, it was the Air Force fed us. But the next day we jumped up to southern Italy. North Africa had been completely won by then. And we landed at a little town called Gioia. We couldn't go to our regular camp because the mission for that day was just coming back, and they were using the air base as landing strips. So we waited there for several hours. And while we were there, a couple of planes had landed there that were shot up a bit. But the crews were men that I had known back at Moorhead State Teachers College. They had all had been in combat, and they were ahead of us. So it was a little bit of a reunion there. And,
mm-hmm.
But then we got up to where we're going to be permanently ensconced, the Amendola Air Base at Foggia, Italy, which is the air base we used was one that the Italians used in World War I. The Italians were our allies in World War I, and they had the only bomber. The British and the French had fighters, the Jenny and the Spitfire, but they had no bombers. But the Italian, I didn't know the name of that bomber. It was named after the inventor, but I can't control it now. But we sent Yanks over to fly that in World War I, and one of them was Fiorella LaGuardia. Name ring a bell?
It sounds like an airport in New York.
It's a generational thing, I can. Yeah, he was mayor of New York, named LaGuardia Field after him, of course. And he used to read the funnies on the radio Sunday morning to the kids. But he was a captain in the old Army Air Corps. It flew those bombers over the Alps into Germany.
Hmm.
So we shared that base with the British. They were a branch of the 82nd Fusiliers. They flew night missions, and we flew day missions. I got to know some of them, and they were great guys. They flew in small squadrons of like three bombers. And if they didn't get caught in the lights, you know, they could. But they kind of refused to fly day missions anymore because of the constant knockdowns. So they had a lot of losses. But they would be coming back in the morning as we were getting ready to go out. I'd be calling the tower. They'd say, well, we got one or two dead aboard and a couple of wounded. What's for breakfast, you know? They were very British about it. But I got to know one guy. His name was Robert Bruce McLean. And it slipped me into their mess once in a while because they got a rum ration every day. Every Brit had a silver cup with equivalent to a double shot. And he'd slip me his cup, and I'd get a double shot of rum. But they had things like steak and kidney pie and fish and chips, and it was a little different from our mess, you know.
What was your typical mess?
Pretty much meat and potatoes, you know.
Yeah. So you wanted something a little bit different every now and again.
Oh, never. Yeah.
And nothing wrong with a little double shot of rum on occasion.
Yeah, right. But he gave me his bonnet, his Glengarry bonnet, which I still have. Maybe I should have brought some of these things today. But he said, if you ever get to Scotland, wear my bonnet. So some years later, my sister and I, we did a lot of traveling in Europe. We got to Scotland, and I wore his bonnet. But we found the town, he lived in the town of Dornoch.
Yeah, which, it's up in the north.
Yes, beautiful little place. But everybody knew everybody in the town. So we inquired at the church if Robert Bruce got back. They said he got back, but he's in the cemetery out here. He got back in a coffin. Mm. They took us out, showed us his grave. And that hat means so much more. So much more to me now than it did before that, you know. But where were we here now?
Well, you were talking about the day missions and the night missions, and
they'd be coming back.
And yeah. So talk to me about what these missions are. What are you going out there and doing?
Well, we had briefing. We were up at about 4 a.m., I guess. The radio operators had a separate mission because we got all the codes for the day and all the paperwork, which incidentally, if we were going down, we put all those codes inside the radio and pushed the button. There was a bomb in there that blew everything up. But and the pilot and the co-pilot and the navigator, they had their own briefing. They got the targets for the day. But it was common knowledge. There were spies in the camp. They usually were children. They would post the target for the day on a bulletin board, and these people would convey it to the krauts, you know, these kids, because it was these radio people, Axis Sally. Have you ever heard of Axis Sally?
No.
She'd get on the radio, and she'd tell you where you're coming. We'll be ready for you when you get here. I think she was either American or British or something like that. A traitor, of course.
Sure.
But they tried to scare you. Your wives and girlfriends are home making love to other men while you're over here fighting and all the demoralizing sort of thing. But Axis Sally. So the target was pretty well known throughout Europe. So we'd rally, we took off, but there were several bomb groups, you know, all over southern Italy, and it'd take us several hours to rally. Maybe we put 1,000 bombers together. And when you went into a target with 1,000 bombers, you looked out the window and you said, that is Uncle Sam. You know, It's a great thing to see 1,000 B-17s flying into combat. Our first mission was rather what we call a milk run. It was Castle something. It was to a chemical factory, and it was a rather simple target with very little aircraft and no fighters, so that was a good break-in for us, you know. But they all weren't that good. Our targets primarily were oil. I was on the last mission to Ploiești in Romania. If you didn't have religion before you went to Ploiești, you had it afterwards, you know. And fortunately, I wasn't on the first mission. We had about 7 or 8 major missions, because that was Hitler's major oil supply, Ploiești. And it was well fortified.
So that was a dangerous mission.
Very dangerous, very dangerous.
But a very strategic.
Very. Yeah. He didn't want to lose all that oil.
And we didn't want to allow him to have all that oil.
And we hit there were 7 oil refineries around Vienna. And then he had a synthetic oil refinery at a place called Wiener Neustadt. It was about as big as Villanova, I think it was. And we had to make many flights up there to knock it out. But getting back to Ploiești, I'll interject this. A lot of the planes got shot up pretty badly. But they would start home and they'd get as far as Yugoslavia and they'd either have to crash land or bail out. Now, when we first got to Europe, we backed a gentleman called, he had been general of the army when Yugoslavia was a monarchy. His name was Mihailovic. And he had a group called the Chetniks. Germans occupied the whole country at this time. But he was an underground chap. And he took all these downed airmen in, put a few in each village and try to get enough food for them. And meanwhile, Marshal Tito came on the screen. And he was communist and he had a little hookup with Russia. So the British backed him, particularly Churchill. So we stopped backing Mihailovic. We started backing the communists. So.
Tito, right.
Yes. And the thing is, we did nothing. The numbers of airmen that were down reached 500, and we did nothing to get them out. This is what they didn't want to hear at the Pentagon. It's called the Forgotten 500. And while Bill Donovan was head of the OSS at the time, which became the CIA, he had formed this group, and he was Wild Bill, but he had a lot of wealthy people in there who had been to Europe and were bilingual and that sort of thing. He used their talents. And one of them was that radio cook lady that maybe the girls know her.
Julia Child?
Yes. She was one of his operatives, only she went to Burma. But he said he was going to get these GIs out of Yugoslavia. So he had them built. We dropped in guys with black parachutes and radios, and they had these guys build an airstrip up in the mountains right under the nose of the Germans. And when it was finished, we flew in C-47s, and we got every one of those guys out. They had to leave their shoes behind because Mihailovic's army didn't have shoes. So they left their shoes behind. That's the happy part. Then Tito accused Mihailovic of conspiring with the Germans, had him arrested. The 500 that he Freed marched around the city hall in New York City protesting this arrest by Tito. Tito had him executed and buried in an unmarked grave. And as I told him at the Pentagon, we could have saved this man with ease. Send a brigade over there, maybe even done it diplomatically, but they let him swing in the wind. There was a few red faces on that.
Yeah, I'm sure. They didn't want to hear that.
No, but I knew a lot of those guys that were freed. You know, they were fellow flyers, fellow airmen. But it was a great thing, at least, to get them freed. And then, as I say, we continually bombed the oil refineries. We always had a military target. I can't say the same for the British, because but they suffered a little different war than we did. But Air Marshal Harris, he was the one that picked these German targets out for the British, and they carpet bombed municipalities. They weren't particularly after a military target, but we refused to bomb anything that was not a military target. It made me feel pretty good. But there was one non-military target. Fortunately, I had not joined the group yet at this time. I joined the group, it was about Christmas 1944 when we got into the... We were the 2nd Bomb Group, 15th Air Force. But in February of that year, there was a monastery called Monte Cassino Abbey, and it was in the path toward Rome. It took our army a year to fight from Naples to Rome. And Kesselring was the German general, and he was an expert. He stopped it was the British Army and our 8th Army and the British 5th Army were struggling north. Well, they hit Monte Cassino, and they were stopped there. And it wasn't so much for the Abbey, but there was, I think, the Rapido River came, all the rivers that came out of the Alps into the Adriatic. He had the Maginot Line, the Hitler Line, and stopped everything on the way north. Well, it was an Australian general that said that the Germans were using the Abbey as an artillery base, and it should be bombed. Well, Mark Clark flew over it, our general, and he didn't see any German artillery or Germans in there. And he was right, because Kesselring had been educated by the Benedictines, and he said, hands off the Abbey. And the monks were still in there. But what never came out, probably for a reason, it was 250 men, women, and children had taken refuge in the Abbey, thinking it wouldn't be bombed. Well, then Churchill got on the same tact, and he said the Abbey should be bombed. So they listened to him. On February the 14th, at 9 a.m., we flew 47 bombers up and leveled the Abbey.
And everyone in it?
The monks survived. They went down in what they call the crypt. But they never said anything about the 250 men, women, and children, the civilians. Never heard anything more about them. But I think every one of them were annihilated. Normally, I'd have been on the first plane, you know. Fortunately, it wasn't there. They didn't want to hear that at the end. But these are things that just happen in wartime. And that happened in February, and it was May before they finally took the Abbey, because when it was a ruin, then the Germans moved into the ruins, and it was a real fortification. And it held us back from February until May. Finally, the Polish troops took it in May, and the Allies were able to proceed north into Rome. Rome fell the same day as D-Day. People don't know that, but we got page 7, I think, you know, because D-Day got page 1. We took Rome, that was in June the 6th. Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting part of the war. The Germans still held everything north of Rome.
Sure.
And we'd fly over every morning. But we had R&R. And incidentally, right near our air base was a little town called San Giovanni Rotondo. And the parish priest there was Padre Pio, who was a Capuchin Franciscan priest. And he had the stigmata. He had the 5 wounds of Christ. But we'd go up there to hear Mass. I got to know him pretty well. And in fact, he wanted me to serve his Mass one day, but the Italian Latin was mostly Italian and not Latin, and I wasn't familiar with it. I wish I'd have given it a try now. I knew he'd be canonized someday, but I still call on him. I said, I knew you, Pio, you know. Believe it or not, some of the favors I've got, you'd be surprised. But that was a high spot. And then I had R&R in Rome for a week or so, and we lived in Mussolini's troops barracks. That's where we lived for R&R. But
what did you do on R&R? Well, do you get to see some sights?
We saw the sights, but the highlight was I had a private audience with the Pope. The Red Cross was giving us tours, but we could see, but they were only able to hit the highlights. So we asked if we could get our own personal guide. And they said, we'll get you a guide, 3 of us. So we got this chap. They said, come around the next morning, we'll have a guide for you. His name was Francesco Federici. He had been educated in the United States, and he was kind of the go-to guy. He knew everybody in Rome. But he took us into places where you never will get. The Vatican Art Gallery, but the highlight was the Vatican Stacks. Nobody gets in the Vatican Stacks. They have paperwork in there from before Christ.
And you got to see it all.
Yeah. We've been an hour down there, I guess. But he'd do, knock on the door, he said, give me about 3 American cigarettes. That was the open sesame. With his knowledge and the cigarettes, that's where we got in every place in Rome. But then we had the audience with the Pope. There were 12 of us, they called a private audience. And they were different members of the Allied Army. But when the Pope came out, they said, make sure you say, Viva il Papa. So we all, Viva il Papa, when Pius XII came out. It was a big, tall, very intelligent man. But he'd just look at your insignia and talk to you in your own language. You were proficient in 12 languages. So that was a high spot.
What'd you talk about with the Pope?
Well, he did most of the talking. He hoped that we would be safe for the remainder of the war. He thanked us for freeing Rome and all the rest of it. There was a movie out called The Scarlet and the Black. It's a DVD. If you haven't seen it and you can get a hold of it, that does a pretty good job of describing Rome during those days. If you got inside Vatican City, you were safe, even though the Germans occupied Italy, you know, that part of Italy. But I had 3 friends that made it in there. They walked around the city for 2 or 3 days trying to get in. They finally found a tree with a branch that went over the wall. So up the tree they went and over the branch and down. So they were they were safe, secure. But this Scarlet in the Black gives a lot of that, you know, how they took care of Allied airmen. Gregory Peck, he's the lead in there, does a good job. But that was about all we did on those R&Rs. They were only about a week. But we went back to flying, and on, I guess it was our 13th mission, our ball turret gunner got hit. It was a pretty, you know, he was hanging underneath the bomber. His name was Joe Martin. Fortunately, the seat in that turret was armor plate, and we all had these things like catchers used to wear, breast protectors, and he always sat on his. And when the piece of flak hit him, it had to penetrate the armor plate and the other thing, and it caught him right in the left hip. So it wasn't awfully serious, but scared the hell out of him. And I got him out of the turret and took him up in the radio room. We had to cut his heated suit. We wore heated suits that plugged into the aircraft's electrical supply to get at his wound. Am I running over time?
No, you're good. You're good. Keep going.
And to get at his wound. So we fixed him up. I was the Red Cross on the airplane, you might say.
The combat medic.
But I didn't have to give him a shot or anything like that. We didn't even have antibiotics yet. We had sulfa. So we put a bunch of sulfa in his wound. And of course, we're still at high altitude. And when we cut his suit up, he wasn't getting warm anymore. So it was after the target. And we were able to get back over the Alps and drop down to a much more friendly altitude. So we got Joe into the 61st Station Hospital in Foggia, and he didn't fly anymore, but they fixed him up, and I was able to find in the ball turret the piece of flak that hit him. It was just about as big as your fist. And he was the last one I had any contact with. He only passed away about a year ago. He lived in Fort Worth, Texas. But we both belonged to the Second Bomb Group Association. That's how I got to know him. Lost track of all the rest of the crew. But Joe always claimed I saved his life. I think he would have lived one way or the other. But fortunately, he was the only casualty we had. I had a minor accident. Coming back over the Alps on a future mission, we hit an air pocket, and that bomber dropped 5,000 feet in a matter of seconds. And it took pilot and co-pilot with all their strength to pull that bomber out of it. But I didn't have my seatbelt on, and when that bomber dropped, my head hit the ceiling, and I split my head open. So it bled like hell. Didn't break any bones. But when we got back on the ground, I went up to the flight surgeon. He said, I can clean that up. So he did. He bandaged me up. He said, now, you can get down to the highway and thumb it into the 61st Station Hospital. You stay overnight, maybe they give you a Purple Heart. Or you can go to dinner. I said, well, sir, I haven't eaten since 4 o'clock this morning. I'll pass up the Purple Heart and go to dinner. So I went to dinner. And
hopefully the dinner was some good food.
We had good food.
Right. Yeah.
But the thing was, I was all bandaged up. And there were two new crews that had come over from the States. And they saw me, you know, with the little blood on the bandages. And they panicked. And this is what we're getting into. The sad thing was, the very next morning, it was a rainy morning, and they flew a practice mission. They used to do this when you weren't flying a combat mission. And these two new crews were involved in this practice mission. One of them smacked into a mountainside and killed the whole crew that I had seen just the night before in the mess hall. They had to send the infantry up there to get them out, you know, the bodies. But that was a sad...
Yeah, it's terrible.
There were things that we, you know, shouldn't have done things like that. You know, it's pouring rain, cloudy day. These people didn't know the terrain, didn't know there was a mountain there, and smacked into it. Another thing they asked me at the Pentagon, I said, another thing I disliked was 4 weeks before the war was over, they sent us to Berlin. Now, Berlin had been leveled by the 8th Air Force from England for 2 years. It wasn't hardly a stone upon a stone left. And I think they just wanted to get it in the books that we had bombed Berlin. It was a 7-hour flight from southern Italy to Berlin. Luckily, I was not scheduled to fly. But they took, I think, 147 bombers up there to bomb the Opel car factory, which was making tanks. So what if they were making tanks? They didn't have enough gas. We found aircraft on the ground that never had a drop of gasoline in them. So 4 weeks before the end of the war, they're worried about somebody making tanks. The sad part is we lost two crews 4 weeks before the end of the war. Didn't like to hear that at the Pentagon. They did tell me, they said, today we would have had some input. You know, even the listed men would have had some input today and maybe scratched that mission. Because we knew the war was practically over. We ran out of targets. So, but that was another sad story.
A little bird is telling me that you have an interesting story about the German Luftwaffe prisoners of war.
Yeah, we had a good relationship with the Luftwaffe. They never joined the Nazi party, to the chagrin of Adolf Hitler. And a common denominator that we were flyers. They called it Brutalein, little brothers. And we had a little POW containment on our base. And they ate the same food we did. Uh-huh. They saw the same movies we had. The word got back to Germany, and they tried to treat us in a similar manner. It stuck to the Geneva Convention. And so that was a good thing. There was one incident. It was well publicized. In fact, it was in the Philadelphia papers. A B-17 was shot up on a mission, and his compass was shot up. And he thought he was flying back to England, but he was flying east. And all of a sudden, this ME-109 came up. He had... One of his crew was dead, and two or three were severely injured, and he had a big hole in the fuselage. But he thought this ME-109 was going to finish him off. But he waggled his wings and he followed me. So he escorted him all the way back over Germany, all the way over these anti-aircraft batteries, but they saw the ME-109. They thought he was in control. Took him all the way to the French coast and gave him a salute, sent him home. It's called A Higher Calling. There's a book out for that same title, A Higher Calling. But that's how the Luftwaffe, a gentleman, you know, he can still fight a war in a gentlemanly fashion. But it was an interesting thing. When the war was over in Europe, before Japan surrendered, we had R&R up in Rome again. And we were near the Vatican, and everybody was running up toward the Castle San Angelo. So we ran with everybody, and I was standing on the curb, and this big open car came by, and in the back seat was King Victor Emmanuel and his son Umberto II. They put the king back on the throne right after the war, but only for about a month. June the 2nd was the 4th of July in Italy. That's when they voted to have a democracy. But as the car came by, Umberto was only about as close as you and I, so I put my hand out, and Umberto put his hand out, and I shook his hand. And it was interesting. The rest of the family went to Switzerland after it became a democracy. But they also had an estate in Portugal, which I didn't know till my sister and I were on a trip to Portugal. And we were on the bus on a coast road, and the bus stopped to point out some archaeological machination that the sea had carved out. And we got off the bus, but on the other side of the road, I saw these two pillars, and one of them had a little sign that said Italia. And as I stood there, a convertible came out the driveway, and who was driving it? Umberto II. Hmm. Twice in one lifetime. I was giving a talk to the Italian American Club in Chestnut Hill. They said, did you shake hands with him the second time? I would have, I guess, had I been close enough, but that was a real kick, you know, it was an unusual situation. So it was pretty much all over by then. The thing had broken out in North Korea. We thought maybe we'd be sent to North Korea, but I guess they didn't need a bomb group. At least they didn't need our bomb group. But I had tallied up enough points. I don't know what the break point was, but I had 96 points, and this entitled me to get out. So I had an opportunity to come back either in a war-weary airplane or on a ship. Well, just before I made up my mind, a war-weary airplane full of GIs crashed on takeoff, and most of them were killed after having fought a war. So I naturally chose the surface vessel. I came back on a victory ship, the Lake Charles Victory, and it was just a few airmen and the 52nd Infantry, the Blue Devils, and they were a hard bunch of men. They had been in the line for about 2 months, and they lost a lot of their personnel. They had a grievance with an officer, and I'm not going to go into the details of that, which I'd rather forget, but I was in charge of feeding these guys. We had 2 meals a day, and have 3 meals, we had 2 meals a day. But I gave them everything I could get, extra milk, extra everything. So they confided in me and told me a lot of their secrets. But they had a big poker game going in the galley. There were 3 guys ended up with all the money, and it narrowed down to 1 guy, and he walked away with $6,000. He had the ship's captain put it in the safe till he got back home. It was just a sea of faces in there watching each card flip over.
Right.
But that was...
How long was that journey home on the ship?
14 days from Italy through the Mediterranean and across the Atlantic. We came into Newport News. It was an interesting thing. An old Irishman told me why they named the Strait of Gibraltar, Gibraltar, on the rock, of course. He said, when you come out of the Mediterranean, to either go north or south, you had to alter your jib sail in the old sailing ship days. So, jib alter, I think you...
I get it.
You get it?
Interesting. The things you learn.
Yeah, with old Jim Lockett, he taught me that. So, fortunately, it was I think I lost 30 pounds on that trip back, which I needed to do. But after feeding these guys, and I hardly got any sleep or anything else, you know. So after we got off of Newport News, we hired a car, a bunch of us, most they included me, and we drove up to Washington, and then I was able to get a train to Philadelphia, and then out into the suburbs and home. But luckily, As I mentioned early in the interview, I had already worked for the federal government for 10 months. And under the GI Bill, they had to reserve your position until you returned. And if someone had temporarily taken over your job and they got any raises or anything, you acquired them when you came back. You got your job back. Well, my job had been taken over by a lady who had a college degree, and they gave her a higher rating. And when I came back, I got her rating. But fortunately, she married the boss. So no hard feelings. She just passed away to a couple of months ago. Nice lady. But the GI Bill was a wonderful thing. It was Harry Truman that signed that. And they had to fly a senator in from one of the Midwestern states at midnight to give the one vote that passed it, because it was not welcomed by everybody. My father was a Democratic committee man at that time, and they had meetings. And we lived in Windmore was a very wealthy area. It was all big estates, and then those that worked for them. You know. But they did not want a free education for the general population. So it was a hard-fought thing. And this one vote for this senator that the American Legion flew in from Nebraska or someplace at midnight, it cast that one deciding vote. And that gave a free education to 12 million guys. And we had prosperity through the 60s and 70s, you know, that we haven't had since. But I went back to the laboratory and picked up my job. And then I was able to get leave of absence for all the school years and then go back there and work in the summertime. So I got my bachelor's degree at Penn State, got a master's degree at the University of Maryland, and a doctor's degree at the University of Massachusetts, free. Try that today. But it was a wonderful opportunity. My dad had been a machinist. I might have struggled to get some sort of education, but that made it a lot easier, I'll tell you. And I worked at the laboratory in between the summers. And then I spent the rest of my career there. Did a lot of work on prenatal vitamins and lactose-free milk and things that you hear about today. But I retired at 55, and they counted my Air Force time because it was government time, and I had 40 years in counting that. So after that, I was offered three jobs after I retired, teaching jobs at St. Joe's Prep and another girls' college, but I figured I'd work long enough. And my parents were getting elderly, and so I hung tight and did a lot of hunting and fishing and travel. I took my sister to Europe about five times, and we saw a lot of great things. I know Europe from one end to the other, the names of the streets practically. But that sort of brings me up pretty much to the present. You know, my parents became ill and passed away. My father lived to be almost 100. My mother lived to be 95. And then I was relegated to take care of two of my mother's sisters till they passed away. And then my sister came along, and she just passed away a couple of years ago. We took care of her, and she lived to be 94. So I'm into horses. I have a riding club at one of the stables, and I have five horses and 15 members, and I compete in the Devon Horse Show and things like that. And I still hunt deer and bear, and that's about it.
So you're living you're still living an active lifestyle.
Yeah, he still drives up.
Yeah, very active.
Well, good. I love hearing that. So when you look back in your time in the military, What are some of your fondest recollections?
Well, we had a wonderful crew. Our pilot was named Clifford Foose. He was only 24, but he was a big mess of man. You'd think he was 30 or so, you know. A great pilot. And the day that we really got shot up, I guess number one engine, a piece of flak cut the drive shaft, and we couldn't feather the engine. So it windmilled at a million miles an hour, and it made the plane shake like a milkshake machine. And then it went on fire. We were over Germany at the time. So we rang the bailout bell. Everybody put their chutes on. We were ready to jump. The CO2 bottles between all the engines. The co-pilot pulled the first CO2 bottle, didn't put the fire out. He rang the bailout bell again. We were ready to jump. They pulled the second CO2 bottle. And the fire went out. So we didn't have to jump. That was as close as I could see the guy down there with a pitchfork. but we got up, and number four engine then quit. So we got back over the Alps with two engines. You needed 18,000 feet to get over the Alps and then down through the Brenner Pass. So we made it home. And the pilot got the Distinguished Flying Cross for that mission, which it well deserved. But we had a lot of faith in him, and we could count on to bring us home, including that Boeing B-17. I say Boeing with tongue in cheek, you know, right now with the problem they're having with their new bomber. But I still have a lot of Boeing stock, and it's doing very well.
And now you're living in Flowertown now, right?
Right.
I live just up the street. I live up in Lafayette Hill. But, you know, now that you're not hunting pheasant for dinner anymore, but you're still hunting, you're still active. You know, if someone's listening and is thinking about joining the military, what advice would you give those people?
Well, I've been encouraging my nephew's three sons maybe to join the military. I haven't had any takers yet. But even the Coast Guard, because a military background opens a lot of doors for you. And like yesterday, I bought a chainsaw up at Lowy's. I got a 10% discount. They opened a special register for me because the other one was filled up with people. They have special parking places out front, veterans only. You don't have to even have a card, you know. If you're a veteran, you park there. All these little things add up, you know, and I think I will say I belong to a military club in London because of my affiliation with the Brits, and they take good care of their vets over there, maybe a little more so than we do here. I never paid for a drink over there. I have one of these hats on, you know. They say, "Hey, Yank, how about a drink?" And I belong to this club in London called the Victory Service Club, beautiful club, right near Speaker's Corner in London. And I've been over there now for a couple of years. I'd like to get back again at least once. The dues are £20 a year, though. I think I can find that somewhere, you know. But I like the Brits. My sister and I have eaten at the club a lot of times. They have a buttery for lunch, and we have maybe fish and chips or something great. But what else have I missed here?
Well, I think you've lived a great life, and hopefully we have many more years of you hunting bears and flying to London.
Well, you know, people wonder why I have pushed back the aging process. I kid them, I say it's wine, women, and song, but it's really not. It's a lot of biochemistry. I read the scientific literature constantly, and they're doing an awful lot of work on pushing back the aging process, particularly Harvard. Dr. Sinclair at Harvard, he said he's doing it for his own personal longevity, but he's come out with some wonderful things. And the British just finished a study on a drug called metformin, which is commonly given to diabetics. The British discovered it in 1957, but it took 20 years before we okayed it. But they just found out that it increases the lifespan by 25 or 30 years. Our government has picked up on it. They're working around the clock on it. You're going to be hearing more about it. They're trying to get a clinical trial of 3,000 people. Drug companies aren't sponsoring that because they don't want to hear it, and neither is our NIH, but a private group that's trying to get this group together, you know, to prove the British work was true. I've been aware that it had this propensity, maybe not quite to that extent, but I've been taking it myself for 4 or 5 years. The cheapest dirt, you can take it like jelly beans, I think 2,000 milligrams a day, no side effects. And I think that's one of my contributors, one of many.
What's it called again?
M-E-T-F, metformin. So it's a, you need a prescription for it, but if you have a friendly doctor, you know. And doctors are going to be prescribing it now because NIH is behind it. Our government's behind it. So.
Well, good. I hope it gives you another 25 or 30 years. I think that'd
be
fantastic.
Well, that and a few other things.
Sure. A glass of wine every now and again never hurts anyone.
The first one that Sinclair came up with was discovering the French paradox, why the French can eat pâté de foie gras and smoke like chimneys and still live longer and healthier than we do because they drink red wine every day. Well, Sinclair isolated the active ingredient in the red wine called resveratrol, and that has to do with your telomeres. On every one of your elements, you have a tail like on a polywog. At the end of that tail, you have a telomer. It's like the plastic ends of your shoelaces. And every time that it turns over, every time a scent regenerates itself, the telomere gets a little shorter. Until it gets so short, the cell dies, and that's the end of that cell. But with this resveratrol, prevents that telomere forever getting any shorter. It was on 60 Minutes. He said, thereby you could live forever. And there is a group that claims your lifespan is definitely based on your telomeres. So there's another one. You can write that one down. You can get that over the counter. But, and there's a few more. They just found another one. The space people, they tested the atmosphere, and they found that everywhere on the planet there's an element called pyrrolidinquinone, PQQ for short. And what that does is increases your mitochondria. Your mitochondria are the power elements that make your heart beat, your lungs contract, and everything else. There's nothing else that will give you more of them except this PQQ. You have other things that will maintain the ones you have, although they do decrease as you get older, but PQQ will increase the number that you have. Hmm. Of course, I've been taking that ever since it was, it's only been discovered about a year ago, but the space people discovered that one, PQQ. And a couple more, but they're the three main ones.
Sure. Well, Tom, I think it's been a pleasure sitting here with you today. We've laughed. We've heard some great stories. Yeah. You know, growing up in Windmore with horses and pheasant hunting to taking PQQ is, you know, quite a spread. But it sounds like you've lived a great life thus far.
I have.
And is there anything else you want to add before we wrap it up today?
Well, we should live to be 120. Every other mammal lives to be five times his maturity. Our maturity is about age 25, give or take a year. So therefore, we should live to be 120. And that's what they're shooting for, both at Harvard, Duke, Southern Cal. They're all working on pushing back the aging process. So maybe you guys, you're young enough to take advantage of some of these discoveries. You'll be around collecting Social Security for...
if there's any left.
But that's about all. I enjoy reading the scientific literature constantly, and as I say, we...
And you have your favorite stocks. Yeah.
I was going to be in the Devon Horse Show again this year, but I don't have a driving horse. I was in the carriage class other years. We did well. I had a good carriage horse called Seamus. They called him Famous Seamus the Wonder Horse. And we won ribbons every year at Devon. But he's retired to a farm now, and my friend has a horse, but not quite the same. But we're going to the local, Wissahickon has a big horse parade at the end of this month. So we're going to do that, and that'll probably be the end of my competitive years in
All
horsemanship.
Right. Well. Plenty of good years, though, you spent doing it, so that's good. Well, thanks for coming out today. It's been a pleasure. I know we've all enjoyed hearing your story. And
I enjoyed it very much, gentlemen.
And we look forward to talking to you soon. Thank you much. That concludes this installment of the Voices of Villanova's Veterans, a joint project of the Villanova University Office of Veterans and Military Service Members and Falvey Memorial Library's Distinctive Collections and Digital Engagement Departments. Thank you for listening. For more information and to listen to more interviews, please visit us online at veteransvoices.library.villanova.edu.